fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. Today's special guest is Livio Ramondelli. You know him as the artist behind many of the Transformers comic books and also Kill Lock. He's now the creator and writer of its sequel, Kill Lock Artisan Wraith, from IDW Comic Books. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. Livio Ramondelli. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good. It's nice to speak to you.
Oh, it's completely my pleasure, sir. Your art is absolutely fantastic.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Oh, it's definitely my pleasure. You've done Transformers for a very long time, and I've been so impressed with your artwork. It looks so realistic, considering they're obviously just talking robots. They're so realistic looking that it really makes the story that much more appealing.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I guess I just, you know, I love Transformers growing up. So Especially the animated movie, I think when you look back at it, as a kid, you sort of kind of imagine the world a little more detailed than it actually is. And I mean, that movie's beautiful. But I think like as a kid, it just feels so real that I think what I'm doing now is trying to kind of recreate that feeling I had seeing those characters as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, the artwork that you make, it's so real. It almost looks like it's live action.
That's great. Yeah, I hope. I mean, I'm a huge fan of like Ridley Scott. I love kind of atmospheric lighting and making environments feel very like weathered and lived in. That's one of my favorite things to do.
When I saw the intro to the movie Bumblebee, the artwork almost looks similar to what they did with their CGI, right? That it looks that next level, you know, doesn't look cartoon. It doesn't look like the over-exaggerated CGI Transformers of the original of the other movies, but it has that same kind of just, you feel like you're living in Cybertron at that moment.
Yeah, that opening was incredible. I mean, I certainly loved it. I thought they translated the designs really well. You know, they had a really nice version of the, you know, the G1's designs, but then updating them just a bit to be more kind of real and believable. But man, I thought it was fantastic.
Now, were you a reader of IDW Transformers prior to getting the gig?
You know, I was a bit, but I had followed, like, I definitely was a G1 fan growing up. That was my main love of Transformers. And I had read a couple of Transformers over the years from the different companies that had the license before IDW got it. But yeah, certainly IDW, you know, took it, ran with it. I mean, combined, I think they total will have had it for about 14 years, which that's pretty incredible for how long the continuity, you know, they restarted the continuity, you know, a bit, right. But they had years of continuous stories, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, and I would say as a kid growing up too, Transformers was such a massive thing for me. And that Transformers movie, I will admit, I still own the soundtrack CD. I own the Blu-ray, the DVD, the cassette, and it's paid for on Amazon in case I'm too lazy to get up and put it in the Blu-ray.
I've rebought the Transformers animated movie several times ever since I was a kid. And I was lucky enough to get to do the cover for it for the 30th anniversary Blu-ray. I did the cover for that movie and that was really special. So there's like an interview with me on the disc too, which was amazing because I used to rent that movie on VHS when I was a kid over and over again. So it's pretty wild.
That had to be the most surreal experiences ever to do the artwork for the movie that you love so much.
It was really weird. I had childhood friends who we used to watch Transformers together as kids that I hadn't talked to in years. But when they saw that news, they messaged me and they were like, oh my God, I can't believe it. It like takes us all back. And I'm like, yeah, it does.
It really does. And, you know, I may be in the minority on this, but I'm a proud minority on this. I truly think Rodimus Prime is a fantastic character. Yeah. And I know some people don't like him, but I think he's fantastic. And, you know, Galvatron, Cyclonus, all those characters. I really feel like they stepped up their game during that movie and going forward.
I love Galvatron. I think that scene where Megatron meets Unicron and becomes Galvatron, I think that scene is fantastic. I think it's like really great science fiction. I mean, Rodimus Prime and Hot Rod, it took me a long time to warm up to because Optimus Prime is my favorite character. Yeah, so anyone who is going to be the leader after him is going to have a hard time, especially with the nature of how Optimus Prime died and Hot Rod being questionably responsible, you know. But yeah, but it was funny. And there's something about Galvatron too, the fact that you knew it was sort of Megatron in there still. I think that was easier for me to kind of accept.
It's funny that, was it almost 40 years later? Not quite 40, but maybe 30, 35 years later, people online and Facebook groups for Transformers are still arguing, complaining about Hot Rod and Optimus Prime.
Oh yeah, for sure. That never dies. Well, I think that's a testament to that movie being so effective, you know. Like I saw a screening of it at the Egyptian Theater in Los Angeles a couple years ago, and there was people in the crowd who had never seen the movie before. And when some of the deaths happened, like the first 30 minutes, there was, you know, noticeable gasps in the crowd where they couldn't believe how, like, the brutality of, like, the opening, like, shuttle attack and all that stuff. I mean, pretty crazy.
Yeah. I don't think as a kid I ever expected it, something like that, to happen. Because once again, you live in such a safe world with these cartoons. I mean, these are robots with guns who shoot each other every episode. No one ever gets hurt, really.
Yeah.
I think even Optimus Prime was blown apart a few times in some of the earlier episodes.
Yeah, it is pretty funny that, yeah, the first two seasons are relatively tame. And then they, when the same characters show up to meet each other in the movie, they just kill each other.
So, yeah, and I think what I loved about the Optimus Prime character was that, you know, I mean, Optimus Prime to me was always like this perfect person. You know, this is always this level of perfection. I think I liked the doubt in Optimus Prime, you know, like the kid learning to be the hero and trying to live up to expectations. I thought something I always identify with that way more than the perfection of Optimus Prime.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting, too, to actually live with Hot Rod as a character and then see him become Rodimus Prime, whereas with Optimus, he sort of arrived fully formed, you know, and then later on, you saw some Orion Pax flashbacks, but generally, Optimus Prime arrived as a finished leader, you know?
On Netflix, they had the Transformers Earth War series. Did you watch those as well?
I did, yeah.
When they have Galvatron and Megatron meet with each other, I was like, that was a hell of a moment.
That was cool. There was some good stuff there. I really liked that episode where Megatron goes to tour kind of like the hospital with the really wounded Decepticons. And then you agree, he like wants the power turned off at the end. It's like so brutal. But yeah, there was good stuff in there.
Yeah. So in your opinion, why has Transformers, the legacy, lasted for so long? Once again, considering it basically started off as a toy commercial.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible that especially something like Optimus Prime, who's such a, you know, father figure and a mentor figure to more than one generation at this point, you know, probably at least going on the third generation of people that have grown up with him. It's funny because, yeah, you think about like a just an ad for toys turning into something that emotionally moves people is really great. I think it's a testament to all the wonderful creators over the years who have worked on it. Yeah, and I think that the idea, I think, is endlessly fascinating, you know, the notion that a vehicle can secretly be a robot. There's a really, really cool idea. And I think there's sort of a childlike fairy tale aspect to it. And then there's also kind of a sinister, like, I think the Michael Bay movies did a good job of covering that, of sort of like the sort of brutality of the Decepticons and how scary it would be if, you know, this tank just stands up, you know? I think, and then of course, action-wise and play-wise, it's kind of endless possibilities too.
So what is it about your art style, do you think, that has translated so well to the Transformers characters and worlds?
I don't know. I mean, I grew up like a big giant science fiction fan. So I was like living and breathing, just, you know, the usual stuff, Transformers and Star Wars and everything. And I think it was just kind of, that's all the stuff I was drawing in my free time. So you accumulate that over your entire life and then you get better and better, hopefully. And then, you know, when you bring your own flavor to it, I think it comes with a lot of love because it was, you know, Transformers was something I loved as a kid and all through my life. So when I got to work on it, I had a lot of knowledge about the brand and at least my take on the characters, what that would be. So yeah, I mean, and then science fiction in general is my favorite thing to read and watch. So just that's what I kind of choose to make as well.
So how did you get involved with IDW and their Transformers line? Where was it? Did you just submit a portfolio and they picked it up? Was it, you know, several attempts to get their attention?
I was really lucky, and I tell everyone, you know, luck and preparation kind of really go together. And I think people underestimate how much luck factors into your life. I was at Wildstorm. I was at Jim Lee's company working as a concept artist, and I started doing comic conventions, just like setting up an artist alley. So I would set up and I would have Transformers prints and Star Wars prints and things that I was putting out there. And I was very lucky that Chris Ryle, who was IDW's editor-in-chief at the time, he walked by and he said, "Oh, I like your stuff. Like, you should submit to us." So he gave me his card, which is really amazing that someone that high up at a company randomly walks up to your table, gives you a card. And then about a week later, I got an email from Andy Schmidt, another editor there, who offered me two covers, the Best of Optimus Prime and Best of Megatron trade paperback covers, which was, I was over the moon because it was like, at the time I thought maybe this is the only two I'll ever get to do, but it was like the two top characters. It was basically do whatever you want with them. And I was like, oh man, this is just literally a dream come true, you know? And then Wildstorm eventually kind of got absorbed back into Warner Brothers proper and they dissolved Wildstorm as a separate brand. So I was a free agent at that point. And I went to IDW and said, I would love to do more Transformers if that's possible. And that led to over a decade now of work on it, which is pretty incredible.
So you actually have a master's degree from the Academy of Art University.
Yep.
How has what you learned there helped you evolve as an artist to get to where you are now?
It was an awesome school. I mean, our teachers were literally working in the industry in the daytime and coming to teach us at night. So for example, I had a teacher that was an art director at Pixar. So he was working on Wall-E during the day. And then at 6 p.m., he would tell us like, well, here's what we did today at Pixar. So it was like, it was so awesome. I learned so much. And then it was also like hearing about how the industry works was great because I had gone to a previous school for kind of fine art for my undergrad degree. And that was more, that was kind of basic fundamentals of drawing and painting, but it wasn't really connected to what I was really interested in, which is illustration and, you know, the entertainment world. So grad school, it helped me immensely.
So as someone who is academically trained as an artist, when you look at artwork, are you able to see those who are not academically trained or those who, let's say, are, you know, who at least didn't go to a university or whatever and receive that kind of official training?
It's a good question because these days, I mean, I always tell people you can essentially get all the knowledge of a college and grad school degree from YouTube videos. I mean, you can watch, you know, a master draw and paint for 4 hours straight live and hear them talk through their techniques. It's incredible. The trade-off is that, you know, you don't get the networking aspect and you don't get the, you know, that to be able to ask questions really, unless they're doing like a Q&A, but there's basic fundamentals. There's things like perspective where you can see if a drawing's out of perspective or whatever. But then, you know, what makes an interesting artist too is their own kind of style and what they bring to it. And sometimes the weirdness and the mistakes give them sort of their own unique flavor. I mean, I think there's some artists out there who just draw, you know, everything's technically correct, but it's just sort of, there's a blandness to it, you know, where, you know, to stand out, you want to have a bit of your own style. But yeah, generally you can tell if someone's had training or their knowledge, it's just like little things here and there.
So how long did it take you to find your style or your artistic voice?
It's kind of, it always evolves, you know? I mean, even on Transformers, my stuff at the beginning, I think looks different than it does now because you just sort of, no artist, I think, stays the same their entire career. If you look at the comic book artists that have been around, like, for example, like Eric Larson on Savage Dragon, I love Savage Dragon. His earlier issues look nothing like what the comic looks like now, you know? And you can kind of watch in real time, read over the years, over the hundreds of issues and see it changing. And I don't think any of it's really intentional. I mean, some little things, but I don't think you could get him to draw an issue the same way he did in the beginning right now. And I think I'm the same way. It's like, you just kind of pick up new techniques and you become interested in new things and your style sort of takes on a life of its own.
So when did you decide to go from being strictly an artist to being the artist writer for projects such as Kill Lock?
Yeah, so I had always wanted to do my own original properties, especially science fiction. I'd always wanted to do original science fiction stories. So I'd done creative writing growing up and I was terrible, but I loved doing it. And over the years of just studying, you know, writing, and I love listening to film audio commentaries or people talk about the production of a story, like of a movie. I was like, I really want to try my hand at this. And then when with the Kill Lock, I was like, okay, well, I'm really going to make something. I'm really going to put a lot of effort into this and put it out there. And it was one of the best experiences of my life. You know, I created this world from scratch and I had no idea if anyone would like it. And I put it out there and thankfully it got a nice response. And that's been really wonderful. But yeah, it really just came from a desire to make my own science fiction stories.
Does it change you at all as an artist when you're also the writer of the project, or especially the creator of the project?
Yeah, it's funny because you're sort of on some levels, you're really with the writer, the version of you. And on other levels, you're like, oh, I really don't have to draw all this, but you know, but this is good for the story, right? So, but it's funny too, because it's not like anyone is making you do any of this. You can change, you can draw as little as you want, but it's in service of the story. And so I try and really be objective that way. And then also with comics, you're meeting a really tight page count every month. And then things like surprises have to happen on an even page to flip it over, you know? So when you're writing it, you're sort of working with those constraints as well.
So when you're the artist or the writer, do you ever get angry at the other part of you? Sort of like if you're writing you have a great image you want to draw, but you can't figure out how to get there, but you're just like, screw it, I'm gonna find a way to get this cool image in my head on paper. I'm gonna find a way to make this happen.
Yeah, definitely. That definitely happens. And then also it's like I'm trying to get better at identifying a good idea quicker, because on the story end, you know, it's finished, it's about to come out. There's a sequel to the Kill Lock called The Artist and Wraith that comes out next month. That one that's a much bigger story than the first one. And so I was really trying to work on, there's new characters that show up and how to make them hopefully interesting. And, you know, trying to identify, okay, that's a good idea, move forward on it. Because the first series, I was working around all these other projects to make it. And it was my first time writing something. So I just really didn't know if anyone would respond at all. Now I feel like I have a little bit more confidence going into the next one.
It's being published by IDW, who is more or less well known for working with licensed properties like Transformers, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, G.I. Joe, things of that nature. What was their involvement like helping you to shepherd the creative-owned title of Kill Lock?
So it was unusual because normally with a creator-owned book, the smart thing you do is you write a pitch and you drew like 5 pages of art. I made the entire series before I pitched it to them. So I wrote and drew and had lettered 6 issues of it on my own. And then I handed it to them. So they could, you know, it wasn't just a pitch they were reading. They were reading a finished thing, which is a lot of work and potentially risky. So there was no guarantee they were going to publish it too, because they have a creator-owned committee there that chooses what books go forward. And I had other friends that work on Transformers that their books got turned down. So there's really no guarantee. Thankfully, they all liked it and the entire committee voted to publish it, which was wonderful. So yeah, I mean, that was really it. And then, you know, editorially, there really was nothing added to it much. I mean, there's always work on the actual production of the comic, but in terms of story and art, it got published exactly how I made it.
So that must have taken like tons of courage to sit, do the entire series, have that kind of confidence in the project. Was there a moment where that confidence came from? Was there a moment of doubt where you started wondering, is this the right direction?
Yeah, I mean, because it was a long process. It was about 4 years of working on it around other projects. And so, because the nature of it is you're not making any money off of it until it gets published. So you can pay your bills, you're working on other stuff. And so, you know, over 4 years, you're like, man, is anyone going to like this? Are these ideas good? You know, and then thankfully I have really close friends that are really knowledgeable about storytelling. And I showed some of them like, is this good? And they were really encouraging. And so I was like, okay, if they like it, you know, then there should be more people that will respond to it. So, but yeah, I mean, you always have doubts. There's things in the sequel that I'm wondering. I'm like, I hope people like this. We'll find out.
So so much of the series or the original Kill Lock series centers around in something called the Killer, which is a mechanism that causes all locked robots to die if one dies. So and any number, I think it's 4, 5 main bots. Am I correct on that one?
Four main bots.
If one of them dies, they all die at once. So what is the intention behind the creation of the Kill Lock? Is it more of a form of torment or a form of education?
It's basically, the sequel will get into that a little bit more, but it's the notion that there's this kind of unseen ruling class called the Forgers that they have viewed that their society, because of the nature that it's robots, there's so many of them, the population is just endless basically, that they were seeing so many kind of criminals and aberrations that they decided to come up with a punishment that would handle them in greater number. So that's basically the idea. And then there is this notion that, you know, you can survive the Kill Lock as long as you just learn to live and protect other people. Really, that's kind of the message, but that's easier said than done. And I thought in real life, something like the Kill Lock would be horrific. You know, if you're linked to somebody and they go on vacation to Europe and they make a bad decision, you know, you die one day randomly. That to me felt really horrible. And then the other thing I liked was pairing characters from very different walks of life together. So there's like an alcoholic laborer, there's like an innocent kid, there's a hardened soldier, and then kind of a elite engineer. And those are classes that would never normally hang out together. And they're sort of thrust together to protect each other.
So for these robots, what is death for these robots?
Death would be death kind of like us, where it's, or I mean, I would say it's more like there is nothing beyond, right? Like when you go offline, that's death, you know? So there is no afterlife for them.
Is there backstory on where the robots come from? Is there a pre-robot civilization that they came into?
That's an excellent question. Yes, there is an answer for that in the sequel.
Like I said, I did have the pleasure of reading the original issues, and they're just, it's amazing the art behind them. I mean, there's for those of people who love what you did with Transformers, you're going to love what you did with Kill Lock.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Was there an intentional visual through line between the two projects?
Not really. I think it's just kind of the style that I tend to like, you know, like it wasn't really meant to be like my version of Transformers. It was, in fact, I tended to try and go away from Transformers. I viewed Kill-Lock more as like a R-rated Pixar movie. I wanted the designs intentionally to be a little simpler. Yeah. Like I wanted them to be really like, basically almost anyone could draw these characters. They're rough shapes. Their colors are very different from one another. So
as you mentioned, in the original Kill-Lock, there's a soldier, an addict, a murderer, and a child. Mm-hmm. So what fascinated you about using or exploring the dynamic between these particular groups?
I like the moral grayness of it all, where you have the artisan who's kind of the most murderous of them, but he's also the most sophisticated. And then you have the laborer who seemingly is caring and compassionate, is also an addict. So in some ways, he's kind of the most dangerous one to the group's safety. And then you have the Wraith, who is a battle-hardened warrior. So he's noble, but he's also like, he kills other robots. I mean, that's his entire existence, is being a soldier. And then you have the innocent kid, who is the only one that's truly like not morally gray. He's just something thrown into this punishment for something he didn't do. And I like that aspect. I like the notion of a kid with kind of three parents and what he would learn from them over time.
So these robots are fully sentient. They do have the ability to adapt, find morality. Being also robots. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. You can go ahead.
I'm going to say, but being robots, is morality programmed?
That's a great question. I don't think it's programmed. I think basically you make your own choices, and something certainly like the Wraith, his whole function of his army is that they're punishing robots who are behaving badly, you know? So I wanted it to be a very human story, even though it's robots. I wanted them to have, you know, they can feel pain, they can love each other, they have addictions, you know, they can feel pleasure. I wanted that stuff to be in there. And it's not like, none of them are programmed to be like a murderer, right? Like, I mean, even the Wraith is a trained soldier, you know? So they're just meant to really be humans.
So the sequel series, as you said, is called The Artisan Wraith, which mm-hmm. which is a badass name, by the way.
Thank you.
It's a really cool name. Thanks. So how does this series further explore the world that you created in Kill-Lock? And does it necessitate reading the original series to understand the new one?
That's a great question. I highly recommend reading the first series first, although I've engineered the second one that you should be able to read it without reading the first. The sequel begins with a new class of robot that's not in the first series. And we hear the events of the first series through these two new robots' eyes. There's basically a fixer class of robot that shows up called the Resolve class. And they are tasked with cleaning up the mess of what happened at the end of the first series. So I think it will stand on its own, but I think like any good sequel, I think it should enrich the first one, and likewise, the first one will enrich this one.
So I think one thing that's interesting is that all these classes, the robots are, for lack of a better word, born into the class, correct?
So it's not said on the page, but the idea of the kid robot, and this is something I do want to visualize at some point, the notion is that unless you're an artist or an Wraith, those are very specifically, you are born exactly that, or you're created exactly that. But if you're like a labor class or some of the other ones, you start off life as an unfinished little robot. You start off as a kind of a kid body. And basically you're given these tasks, and what you excel at or what you fail at will decide what you're going to be built into. So if they find that you're really like, you know, obedient, you're good at lifting things, you'll be considered like a labor class. If they find that you're exceptionally smart at something, you'll become an axial class, which is another class of smart robot. So that's the notion. That's why there's kid robots in this world. It's kind of like testing out you as like a rudimentary creation and what you're able to accomplish. That dictates where you're going to be in society.
That's almost like an idealized view of almost like humanity as well. If you could do exactly what you're good at, that's what you get to do.
Yeah, exactly. And then for good or bad, I mean, there's people who are just born exceptionally beautiful, right? And so their life will be different immediately. And then there's people who are really gifted athletically, you know, and so they will, you know, become a football star or a boxer, you know, they will have opportunities that an average person will not have. And that's fascinating to me. I think that's really interesting, of some of it's genetics, some of it's luck. And I thought that same idea could be applied to kind of a robot civilization.
Now, you did an interview, with a website called Comic Book, and you posed an interesting question. I'm going to read the question, and then I'm going to ask a question if you don't mind.
Sure.
All right. So in the interview, you said if you had both the might and the mind to remake the faults that you see in society, would you improve it or create something worse? Now, what I thought was interesting was that if you saw the faults in society, now, is the initial problem is that there's based on subjective notion of a fault.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
So it's not, so the artisan Wraith's view of fault, that because society has failed to conform to its needs, or does it see in a society that actually is failing everybody?
That's a really, really great question. That's really good. That's the whole theme of the sequel, really, is, you know, if you gave any one of us the ability to reshape the earth, right, we might think we're doing something good because we see problems that need to be, you know, changed and fixed, but not everyone agrees. That's the problem you have with society, is that not everyone's on the same page with issues. So that's why the artisan Wraith represents such a catastrophic risk, because it's the strength and the mind to actually really rewrite society. And it will go up against basically, why was society created that way in the first place? So going back to your question of, you know, is there an origin for the race, that kind of goes up against it. And I thought that was also really interesting too. I mean, you see that now with certain politicians where it's like, they'll try and rewrite the checks and balances that have served their country all this time. Yeah. And sometimes it's catastrophic what they do. Even in their mind, they think they're helping.
So the artisan Wraith is attempting to do the right thing. It's not doing it out of power or anything else. It literally thinks it has a positive purpose.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's this notion of the artisan is a very, very intelligent character. And so it sees, even the Killlock, it sees that as a waste of resources, where like, why are you just punishing the population that you made? Isn't there a better use for them? You know, if there's an alcoholic, it's like, why are we just sending him off to die? You know, so that's really the notion. Now, the artisan himself is like all of us, you know, he's a very complex character and he has his own sort of ruthlessness. And so you see that sometimes with really intelligent people where the science, like I saw this study one time that said, like, if you told an AI to get rid of all the litter on Earth, the AI will conclude we need to kill people because people cause litter. And so that's the danger of something that's so smart and thinking about society on a macro level that you lose the kind of emotional, you know, well-being aspect.
It seems like that's a similar concept that kind of, or at least to me, is similar to where fascist leaders tend to come from, the idea of I know right, and no matter, and whatever I need to do to make it right is right and fair because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think you'll see too, a lot of fascist leaders sort of grew up in among chaos, you know, and they didn't have a happy, stable life. So they sort of see it. That's a theme that repeats all through history where, you know, when they arrive, they sort of see themselves as the savior and oftentimes end up doing something even worse than what they lived through.
I completely agree. I think it seems like history has stated or seems to suggest that the most dangerous person in the world is the one that feels like they have the answer.
Yeah, for sure. And then also, you know, sometimes you mix in the higher power aspect, people that think they've been chosen by God. And so that's really hard to kind of convince them that might not be the case.
So does the artisan Wraith have a view of a higher power? The higher power?
Yeah, I think because he's so science-minded, I don't think he believes in something higher. Although having said that, he, not to tease it, he might encounter something in the sequel that will test his faith.
So, I mean, the Artisan Wraith comes from the initial characters of the first series and the experience of the Killlock. Now, did what he is now, is that formed from that experience, or was he going to head in that direction prior to the Killlock?
I think my read on it was that he had always wanted to formulate a way to kind of reshape society. And so he was biding his time. And it's even in the first issue, he was hiding who he really is, you know, so he would show up and be a model employee, you know, he was nice to everyone, but he's really concealing what he actually was. And then when the Wraith arrives to be sentenced, that's when he realizes he saw the opportunity, right? So even he had a bit of luck in his life where it's like, this is finally, it's going to be hard because the artisan really risks his own life in the first series. I mean, to get the Wraith's body. And so that's the idea, is that he was looking for an answer, and the Wraith arriving was the answer.
Now, is part of the problem is that it is a product of a combination of consciousness. Is he suffering an identity crisis because of this?
Not so much an identity crisis, because it's, he really is in the driver's seat of that body, but there are little hints of, you know, in the sequel, we'll see it, but in this sort of dreamscape world that I call it, where their consciousness are in that kind of blue light that you see at the end of the first series, the notion they share that space and they can all watch what he's doing with the Wraith's body, that will kind of come into play in the sequel.
So similar to an issue that might've come up when you're working on the Transformers, is the idea that once again, you're working with robots. So when you're dealing with robots, how do you develop that empathy for your readers? And what do you, and how are you creating these characters so that the readers want to latch onto them?
That's another good question. Yeah, I think that was really important to me, is that the series emotionally grabbed people. And it was just, I think people respond to empathy. People respond to characters demonstrating that they care about one another, which sounds simple, but I think it's really true. Like I was really happy with the response that I got from the series, where people really emotionally cared about the characters and they were really worried about the safety of the kid, you know? And I think the reason that the series starts the way it does, with the artisan walking into a bar and saying something really offensive, I was like, I want to grab people from the start and say that this is not your average robot story, that these characters are going to be hopefully pretty fleshed out and three-dimensional. And I want you to care about them. And even by the end of the series, hopefully you kind of understand the artisan too.
So what can our listeners look forward to in future issues of the series?
Yeah, I can say the sequel is a much bigger expansion of the world. It deals with more of how their society operates. I think the world building is bigger. It shows the future of the characters in the first series, as well as what kind of the hints at the origins of their civilization. And the Wraith Legion, the actual army, shows up in full force. The army that's seen briefly in the first series is a major part of the next one.
So how vast is the world building in this sequel?
It's much bigger than it was in the first one. The first one is a relatively simple story on purpose, because I wanted to ease people in. I didn't want to bog them down with too much exposition about how the world works. But I got a lot of questions about people wanting to see more of the world, and they had liked those like teases about what else is out there. So I would say it's a much bigger canvas. It's a longer series. It's 7 issues. The first one was 6. And you just continue to journey to new planets and meet new classes of robot.
Is it going to continue into a third series as well?
That is my intention for sure. You know, I would love to do that. And I also thought about doing an anthology that was kind of a collection of short stories about other random robots that are living with the Killlock. So it would be kind of like Twilight Zone-esque, where some of them would have really horrific, you know, things happen, and then some would have funny things. Some may even have a happy ending. You know, I have ideas for that, because then the Killlock by definition lends itself to follow other characters that have it.
Mm. Well, like I said, it was the first series was really well done. I'm looking forward to seeing the second series. When is it going to come out?
Yeah, the first issue comes out March 9th.
March 9th, so it's soon.
Really soon, next month.
So it's going to be available through, I assume, at every stores, Comixology, all that?
Yeah, you can order it through your local comic shop, Amazon, through IDW directly. IDW has an app for comics, so all that stuff.
Well, sir, like I said, the series is awesome. And Mr. Romandelli, it was a pleasure to talk with you. And I really sound like Killlock, Artisan, Wraith is going to be a kick-ass series.
Thank you so much. And really great questions. I really appreciate speaking with you.
Oh, thank you so much. I do appreciate the compliment.
Yeah.
Well, have a very good day, sir. And when it goes live, I'll be glad to send it over to you. And when the next series comes out, stop by.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.